I stopped for more than 5 minutes, the sweat that drenched the back of my t-shirt turned icy cold. I'd seen no one since I left Ashland, but now I encountered a few day hikers and overnight backpackers who'd climbed up to the PCT on one of the many trails that intersected it, which led to peaks above or lakes below. Mostly, I was alone, which wasn't unusual, but the cold made the trail seem even more vacant, the wind clattering the branches of the persevering trees. It felt colder, too. Even colder than it had been up in the snow above Sierra City, though I saw only small patches of snow here and there. I realized it was because back then the mountains had been moving towards summer, and now, only 6 weeks later, they were already moving away from it, reaching toward autumn, in a direction that pushed me out. One night I stopped to camp, stripped off my sweaty clothes, dressed in every other piece of clothing I had, and quickly made dinner, zipping myself into my sleeping bag as soon as I finished eating, chilled to the bone, too cold even to read. I lay curled into myself in a fetal position with my hat and gloves on all night long, barely able to sleep. When the sun rose at last, it was 26 degrees and my tent was covered in a thin layer of snow. The water in my bottles was frozen, though they'd been beside me inside the tent. As I broke camp, without a sip of water, eating a protein bar instead of my regular granola mixed with better than milk, I thought again of my mother. She'd been looming for days, riding low and heavy in my mind since Ashland, and now, finally, on the day of the snow, she was undeniably here. It was August 18th, her birthday. She'd have been 50 that day if she'd lived. She didn't live. She didn't get to be 50. She would never be 50, I told myself as I walked under the cold and bright August sun. Be 50, Mom. Be fucking 50, I thought with increasing rage as I forged on. I couldn't believe how furious I was at my mother for not being alive on her 50th birthday. I had the palpable urge to punch her in the mouth. Her previous birthdays hadn't brought up the same rage. In past years, I'd been nothing but sad. On the first birthday without her, on the day she'd have been 46, I'd spread her ashes with Eddie, Karen, Leaf, and Paul in the little rock-lined flower bed we'd made for her in a clearing on our land. On her three subsequent birthdays, I'd done nothing but cry as I sat very still, listening with great attention to the entire Judy Collins album, Colors of the Day. It's every note seeming to be one of my cells. I could bear to listen to it only once each year, for all the memories of my mother playing it when I was a child. The music made it feel like my mother was right there with me, standing in the room. Only she wasn't, and would never be again. I couldn't allow even a line of it now on the PCT. I deleted each and every song from the mixtape radio station in my head, pressing an imaginary rewind in a desperate scramble, forcing my mind to go static instead. It was my mother's not 50th birthday, and there would be no song. Instead, I passed by high lakes and crossed over blocky volcanic rocks as the night snow melted on the hardy wildflowers that grew among them, hiking faster than ever while thinking uncharitable thoughts about my mother. Dying at 45 had only been the worst thing she'd done wrong. As I hiked, I made a catalog of the rest, listing them painstakingly in my head. 1. She'd gone through a phase during which she'd smoked pot on an occasional but regular basis and had no qualms about doing it in front of my siblings and me. Once, stoned, she'd said, "It's only an herb like tea." 2. It hadn't been uncommon for my brother, sister, and me to be left alone when we lived in the apartment buildings full of single moms. She told us we were old enough to look after ourselves for a few hours because she couldn't afford a babysitter. Plus, there were all those other moms we could go to if something went wrong, she said. But we needed our mom. 3. During this same period, when she became really mad, she often threatened to spank us with a wooden spoon, and a few times she'd followed through. 4. Once she said it was perfectly okay with her if we wanted to call her by her first name instead of calling her mom. 5. She could be cool and often distant with her friends. She loved them, but she kept them at arm's length. I don't think she truly let any one of them all the way in. She held to her belief that blood was thicker than water, in spite of the fact that my family was rather short of blood relations who didn't live hundreds of miles away. She maintained an air of insularity and privacy, participating in the community of friends, but also sealing off our family from it. This was why no one had swooped in when she died, I supposed, why her friends had left me in peace in my inevitable exile. Because she had not held any of them very close, none of them held me. They wished me well, but they didn't invite me to Thanksgiving dinner or call me up on my mom's birthday to say hello after she died. 6. She was optimistic to an annoying degree, given to saying those stupid things, "We're not poor because we're rich in love," or "When one door closes, another one opens up," which always, for a reason I couldn't quite pin down, made me want to throttle her, even when she was dying and her optimism briefly and desolately expressed itself in the belief that, in fact, she wouldn't die, so long as she drank a tremendous amount of wheatgrass juice. 7. When I was a senior in high school, she didn't ask where I would like to go to college. She didn't take me on a tour. I didn't even know people went on tours until I went to college and others told me they'd gone on them. I was left to figure it out on my own, applying to a single college in St. Paul, for no reason whatsoever other than it looked nice on the brochure and it was only a 3-hour drive away from home. Yes, I had slacked a bit in high school, playing the dumb blonde so I wouldn't be socially ostracized because my family lived in a house with a honey bucket for a toilet and a wood stove for heat, and my stepfather had long hair and a big bushy beard and drove around in a demolished car that he'd made into a pickup truck by himself with a blowtorch, a chainsaw, and a few 2x4s. And my mother opted not to shave under her arms and to say things to the red-blooded gun-loving locals like, "Actually, I think hunting is murder." But she knew I was secretly smart. She knew I was intellectually avid, devouring books by the day. I'd scored in the upper percentiles on every standardized test I ever took, to everyone's surprise but hers and mine. Why hadn't she said, "Hey, maybe you should apply to Harvard. Maybe you should apply to Yale"? The thought of Harvard and Yale hadn't even crossed my mind back then. They seemed to be utterly fictitious schools. It was only later that I realized that Harvard and Yale were real. And even though the reality is they wouldn't have let me in, I honestly wasn't up to their standards. Something inside me was smashed by the fact that there'd never even been the question that I could give them a shot. But it was too late now, I knew. And there was only my dead, insular, overly optimistic, non-college-preparing, occasionally child-abandoning, pot-smoking, wooden spoon-wielding, feel-free-to-call-me-by-my-name mom to blame. She had failed. She had failed. She had so profoundly failed me. Fuck her, I thought, so mad that I stopped walking. And then I wailed. No tears came, just a series of loud brays that coursed through my body so hard I couldn't stand up. I had to bend over, keening, while bracing my hands on my knees, my pack so heavy on top of me, my ski pole clanging out behind me in the dirt, the whole stupid life I'd had coming out my throat. It was wrong. It was so relentlessly awful that my mother had been taken from me. I couldn't even hate her properly. I didn't get to grow up and pull away from her and bitch about her with my friends and confront her about the things I wished she'd done differently, and then get older and understand that she had done the best she could and realize that what she had done was pretty damn good, and take her fully back into my arms again. Her death had obliterated that. It had obliterated me. It had cut me short at the very height of my youthful arrogance. It had forced me to instantly grow up and forgive her every motherly fault, at the same time that it kept me forever a child. My life both ended and begun in that premature place where we'd left off. She was my mother, but I was motherless. I was trapped by her, but utterly alone. She would always be the empty bowl that no one could fill. I'd have to fill it myself again and again and again. "Fuck her," I chanted, as I marched on over the next few miles, my pace quickened by my rage, but soon I slowed and stopped to sit on a boulder. A gathering of low flowers grew at my feet, their barely pink petals edging the rocks. Crocus, I thought, the name coming into my mind because my mother had given it to me. These same flowers grew in the dirt where I'd spread her ashes. I reached out and touched the petals of one, feeling my anger drain out of my body. By the time I rose and started walking again, I didn't begrudge my mother a thing. The truth was, in spite of all that, she'd been a spectacular mom. I knew it as I was growing up. I knew it in the days that she was dying. I knew it now. And I knew that was something, that it was a lot. I had plenty of friends who had moms who, no matter how long they lived, would never give them the all-encompassing love that my mother had given me. My mother considered that love her greatest achievement. It was what she banked on when she understood that she really was going to die, and die soon. The thing that made it just barely okay for her to leave me and Karen and Leif behind. "I've given you everything," she insisted again and again in her last days. "Yes," I agreed. She had, it was true. She did. She did. She did. She'd come at us with maximum maternal velocity. She hadn't held back a thing, not a single lick of her love. "I'll always be with you, no matter what," she said. "Yes," I replied, rubbing her soft arm. When she'd become sick enough that we knew she was really going to die, when we were in the home stretch to hell, when we were well past thinking any amount of wheatgrass juice would save her, I'd asked her what she wanted done with her body, cremated or buried, though she only looked at me as if I were speaking Dutch. "I want everything that can be donated to be donated," she said after a while. "My organs, I mean. Let them have every part they can use." "Okay," I said. It was the oddest thing to contemplate, to know that we weren't making impossibly far-off plans, to imagine parts of my mother living on in someone else's body. "But then what?" I pressed on, practically panting with pain. I had to know. It would fall on me. "What would you like to do with what's left over? Do you want to be buried or cremated?" "I don't care," she said. "Of course you care," I replied. "I really don't care. Do what you think is best. Do whatever is cheapest." "No," I insisted. "You have to tell me. I want to know what you want done." The idea that I would be the one to decide filled me with panic. "Oh, Cheryl," she said, exhausted by me, our eyes meeting in a grief-stricken detente. For every time I wanted to throttle her because she was too optimistic, she wanted to throttle me because I would never, ever relent. "Burn me," she said finally. "Turn me to ash." And so we did. Though the ashes of her body were not what I'd expected, they weren't like ashes from a wood fire, silky and fine as sand. They were like pale pebbles mixed with a gritty gray gravel. Some chunks were so large I could see clearly that they'd once been bones. The box that the man at the funeral home handed to me was oddly addressed to my mom. I'd brought it home and set it under the cupboard beneath the curio cabinet where she kept her nicest things. It was June. It sat there until August 18th, as did the tombstone we'd had made for her, which had arrived the same week as the ashes. It sat in the living room, off to the side. A disturbing sight to visitors, probably. But it was a comfort to me. The stone was slate gray, the writing etched in white. It said her name, and the dates of her birth and death, and the sentence she'd spoken to us again and again as she got sicker and died. "I'm with you always." She wanted us to remember that. And I did, It felt like she was with me always, metaphorically at least. And in a way, it was literal too. When we'd finally laid down that tombstone and spread her ashes into the dirt, I hadn't spread them all. I'd kept a few of the largest chunks in my hand. I'd stood for a long while not ready to release them to the earth. I didn't release them. I never, ever would. I put her burnt bones into my mouth and swallowed them whole. By the night of my mother's 50th birthday, I loved her again, though I still couldn't bear to let the Judy Collins songs come into my head. It was cold, but not as cold as the night before. I sat bundled in my tent, wearing my gloves, reading the first pages of my new book, The Best American Essays, 1991. I usually waited until morning to burn whatever pages I'd read the night before, but on this night, when I was done reading, I crawled out of my tent and made a fire of the pages I'd read. As I watched them ignite, I said my mother's name out loud, as if it were a ceremony for her. Her name was Barbara, but she'd gone by Bobby, so that was the name I spoke. Saying Bobby instead of Mom felt like a revelation, like it was the first time that I truly understood that she was my mother, but also more. When she died, I'd lost that too, the Bobby she'd been, the woman who was separate from who she was to me. She seemed to come at me now, the full, perfect, and imperfect force of her humanity, as if her life was an intricately painted mural and I could finally see the whole thing, who she'd been to me and who she hadn't, how it was she belonged to me profoundly, and also how she didn't. Bobby hadn't been granted her last wish, that her organs be used to help others, or at least not to the extent that she had hoped. When she died, she was ravaged with cancer and morphine, her 45-year-old body a toxic thing. In the end, they could use only her corneas. I knew that part of the eye was nothing but a transparent membrane, but when I thought of what my mother had given, I didn't think of it that way. I thought of her astounding blue eyes living on in someone else's face. A few months after my mom died, we'd received a thank you letter from the foundation that facilitated the donation. Because of her generosity, someone could see, the letter said. I was mad with desire to meet the person, to gaze into his or her eyes. He or she wouldn't have to say a word. All I wanted was for whoever it was to look at me. I called the number on the letter to inquire, but was quickly brushed aside. Confidentiality was of the utmost importance, I was told. There were the recipient's rights. I'd like to explain to you about the nature of your mother's donation, the woman on the phone said in a patient and consoling voice that reminded me of any number of the grief counselors, hospice volunteers, nurses, doctors, and morticians who had addressed me in the weeks during which my mother was dying and in the days after she died. A voice full of intentional, almost overstated compassion, which also communicated that in this, I was entirely alone. It wasn't the entire eye that was transplanted, the woman explained, but rather the cornea, which is... I know what the cornea is, I snapped. I'd still like to know who this person is, to see him or her if I can. I think you owe me that. I hung up the phone, overcome with grief, but the small, reasonable core that still lived inside of me knew that the woman was right. My mother wasn't there. Her blue eyes were gone. I'd never gaze into them again. When the flames from the pages I'd burned had gone out and I'd stood to return to my tent, the sound of high and frenzied barks and howls came to me from the east, a pack of coyotes. I'd heard that sound in northern Minnesota so many times it didn't scare me. It reminded me of home. I looked up at the sky, the stars everywhere and magnificent, so bright against the dark. I shivered, knowing I was lucky to be here, feeling that it was too beautiful to go back into my tent just yet. Where would I be in a month? It seemed impossible that I wouldn't be on the trail, but it was true. Most likely, I'd be in Portland, if for no other reason than that I was flat broke. I still had a small bit of money left over from Ashland, but nothing that wouldn't be gone by the time I reached the Bridge of the Gods. I let Portland roll around in my mind through the days as I passed out of the Sky Lakes wilderness into the Oregon desert, a high, dusty, flat plain of lodgepole pines that my guidebook explained had been smattered with lakes and streams before they were buried beneath the tons of pumice and ash that had fallen on them when Mount Mazama erupted. It was early on a Saturday when I reached Crater Lake National Park. The lake was nowhere in sight. I'd arrived instead at the campground 7 miles south of the lake's rim. The campground wasn't just a campground. It was a mad tourist complex that included a parking lot, a store, a motel, a little coin laundromat, and what seemed to be 300 people revving their engines and playing their radios loud, slurping beverages from gigantic paper cups with straws and eating from big bags of chips they bought in the store. The scene both riveted and appalled me. If I hadn't known it firsthand, I wouldn't have believed that I could walk a quarter mile in any direction and be in an entirely different world. I camped there for the night, showering blissfully in the bathhouse, and the next morning made my way to Crater Lake. My guidebook had been correct. My first sight of it was one of disbelief. The surface of the water sat 900 feet below where I stood on the rocky 7,100-foot-high rim. The jagged circle of the lake spread out beneath me in the most unspeakably pure ultramarine blue I'd ever seen. It was approximately 6 miles across, its blue interrupted only by the top of a small volcano, Wizard Island, that rose 700 feet above the water, forming a conical island upon which twisted foxtail pines grew. The mostly barren, undulating rim that surrounded the lake was dotted with these same pines and backed by distant mountains. Because the lake is so pure and deep, it absorbs every color of visible light except blue, so it reflects pure blue back to us, said a stranger who stood beside me, answering the question I'd nearly uttered out loud in my amazement. Thanks, I said to her. Because the water was so deep and pure, it absorbed every color of visible light except blue, seemed like a perfectly sound and scientific explanation. And yet there was still something about Crater Lake that remained inexplicable. The Klamath tribe still considered the lake a sacred site, and I could see why. I wasn't a skeptic about this. It didn't matter that all around me there were tourists taking pictures and driving slowly past in their cars. I could feel the lake's power. It seemed a shock in the midst of this great land. Inviolable, separate and alone, as if it had always been and would always be here, absorbing every color of visible light but blue. I took a few photographs and walked along the lake's rim, near a small gathering of buildings that had been built to accommodate tourists. I had no choice but to spend the day because it was a Sunday and the park's post office was closed. I couldn't get my box until tomorrow. It was sunny and finally warm again, and as I walked, I thought that if I'd continued with the pregnancy I'd learned about in that motel room in Sioux Falls the night before I decided to hike the PCT, I'd be giving birth to a baby right about now. The week of my mother's birthday would have been my due date. The crushing coalescence of those dates felt like a punch in the gut at the time. But it didn't compel me to waver in my decision to end my pregnancy. It only made me beg the universe to give me another chance, to let me become who I needed to before I became a mother, a woman whose life was profoundly different than my mother's had been. Much as I loved and admired my mother, I'd spent my childhood planning not to become her. I knew why she'd married my father at 19, pregnant and only a tiny bit in love. It was one of the stories I'd made her tell when I'd asked and asked and she'd shaken her head and said, "Why do you want to know?" I'd asked so much that she finally gave in. When she'd learned she was pregnant, she'd pondered two options, an illegal abortion in Denver, or hiding out in a distant city during her pregnancy, then handing over my sister to her mother, who'd offered to raise the baby as her own. But my mother hadn't done either of those things. She decided to have her baby, so she'd married my dad instead. She'd become Karen's mother, and then mine, and then Leif's. Ours.
I never got to be in the driver's seat of my own life,
she'd wept to me once in the days after she learned she was going to die.
I always did what someone else wanted me to do. I've always been someone's daughter or mother or wife. I've never just been me. Oh, Mom, was all I could say as I stroked her hand. I was too young to say anything else.
At noon, I went to the cafeteria in one of the nearby buildings and ate lunch. Afterwards, I walked through the parking lot to the Crater Lake Lodge and strolled through the elegantly rustic lobby with Monster on my back, pausing to peer into the dining room. There was a smattering of people sitting at tables, handsome groups holding glasses of Chardonnay and Pinot Gris like pale yellow jewels. I went outside to the long porch that overlooked the lake, made my way along a line of grand rocking chairs, and found one that was set off by itself. I sat in it for the rest of the afternoon, staring at the lake. I still had 334 miles to hike before I reached the Bridge of the Gods, but something made me feel as if I'd arrived, like that blue water was telling me something I'd walked all this way to know. This was once Mazama, I kept reminding myself. This was once a mountain that stood nearly 12,000 feet tall and then had its heart removed. This was once a wasteland of lava and pumice and ash. This was once an empty bowl that took hundreds of years to fill. But hard as I tried, I couldn't see them in my mind's eye. Not the mountain or the wasteland or the empty bowl. They simply were not there anymore. There was only this stillness and silence of that water. What a mountain and a wasteland and an empty bowl turned into after the healing began. Chapter 17. Into a Primal Gear. Oregon was a hopscotch in my mind. I skipped it, spun it, leapt it in my imagination, all the way from Crater Lake to the Bridge of the Gods, 85 miles to my next box at a place called Shelter Cove Resort, 143 miles beyond that to my final box at Olali Lake. Then I'd be on the home stretch to the Columbia River, 106 miles to the town of Cascade Locks, with a stop for a holy shit I can't believe I'm almost there drink at Timberline Lodge on Mount Hood at the midpoint of that final stretch. But that still added up to 334 miles to hike. The good thing, I quickly understood, was that no matter what happened in those 334 miles, there would be fresh berries along the way, huckleberries and blueberries, salmonberries and blackberries, all of them plump for the picking for miles along the trail. I raked the bushes with my hands as I walked, sometimes stopping to fill my hat as I made my way leisurely through the Mount Thielson and Diamond Peak wildernesses. It was cold, it was hot, the tree bark plucked dead chicken flesh on my hips grew another layer, my feet stopped bleeding and blistering, but they still hurt like hell. I hiked a few half-days, going only 7 or 8 miles, in an effort to alleviate the pain, but it did little good. They hurt deep. Sometimes, as I walked, it felt like they were actually broken, like they belonged in casts instead of boots, like I'd done something profound and irreversible to them by carrying all this weight over so many miles of punishing terrain. This, and yet I was stronger than ever. Even with that tremendous pack of mine, I was capable of hammering out the big miles now, though at day's end I was still pretty much shattered. The PCT had gotten easier for me, but that was different from it getting easy. There were pleasant mornings and lovely swaths of afternoon, 10-mile stretches that I'd glide right over while barely feeling a thing. I loved getting lost in the rhythm of my steps and the click of my ski pole against the trail, the silence and the songs and sentences in my head. I loved the mountains and the rocks and the deer and rabbits that bolted off into the trees and the beetles and frogs that scrambled across the trail. But there would always come the point in each day when I didn't love it anymore, when it was monotonous and hard, and my mind shifted into a primal gear that was void of anything but forward motion. And I walked until walking became unbearable, until I believed I couldn't walk even one more step. And I stopped and made camp and efficiently did all the tasks that making camp required, all in an effort to get as quickly as possible to the blessed moment when I could collapse, utterly demolished, in my tent. That's how I felt by the time I dragged into the Shelter Cove Resort. Spent and bored with the trail, empty of every single thing except gratitude I was there. I'd hopped another of my squares in the Oregon hopscotch. Shelter Cove Resort was a store surrounded by a rustic set of cabins on a wide green lawn that sat on the shore of a big lake called Odell that was rimmed by green forests. I stepped onto the porch of the store and went inside. There were short rows of snacks and fishing lures and a cooler with drinks inside. I found a bottle of Snapple lemonade, got a bag of chips, and walked to the counter. "You a PCT hiker?" the man who stood behind the cash register asked me. When I nodded, he gestured to a window at the back of the store. "The post office is closed until tomorrow morning, but you can camp for free at a spot we've got nearby, and there are showers that'll cost you a buck." I had only $10 left, as I'd now come to expect. My stops in Ashland and Crater Lake National Park had been pricier than I'd imagined they'd be. But I knew I had $20 in the box I'd get the next morning. So when I handed the man my money to pay for the drink and the chips, I asked him for some quarters for the shower. Outside, I cracked open the lemonade and chips and ate them as I made my way toward the little wooden bathhouse the man had pointed out, my anticipation tremendous. When I stepped inside, I was pleased to see that it was a one-person affair. I locked the door behind me, and it was my own domain. I'd have slept inside it if they'd let me. I took off my clothes and looked at myself in the scratched-up mirror. It wasn't only my feet that had been destroyed by the trail, but it seemed my hair had been, too, made coarser and strangely doubled in thickness, sprung alive by layers of dried sweat and trail dust, as if I were slowly but surely turning into a cross between Farrah Fawcett in her glory days and Gunga Din at his worst. I put my coins in the little coin box, stepped into the shower, and luxuriated under the hot water, scrubbing myself with the sliver of soap someone had left there until it dissolved completely in my hands. Afterwards, I dried off with the same bandana I used to wash my cooking pot and spoon with lake and creek water, and dressed again in my dirty clothes. I hoisted Monster on and walked back to the store feeling 1,000 times better. There was a wide porch in front with a long bench that ran along its sides. I sat down on it and looked out at Odell Lake while brushing my wet hair with my fingers. Olali Lake and then Timberline Lodge and then Cascade Locks, I was thinking. Skip, hop, spin, done. "Are you Cheryl?" a man asked as he came out of the store. Within a moment, two other men had stepped out behind him. I knew immediately by their sweat-stained t-shirts they were PCT hikers, though they didn't have their packs. They were young and handsome, bearded and tan and dirty, equal parts incredibly muscular and incredibly thin. One was tall, one was blonde, one had intense eyes. I was so very glad I'd taken that shower. "Yes," I said. "We've been following you a long way," said the blonde one, a smile blooming across his thin face. "We knew we were going to catch you today," said the one with the intense eyes. "We saw your tracks on the trail." "We've been reading your notes in the trail register," added the tall one.
"We were trying to figure out how old you'd be," said the blonde one.
"How old did you think I'd be?" I asked, smiling like a maniac.
"We thought either about our age or 50. said the one with the intense eyes.
"I hope you're not disappointed," I said, and we laughed and blushed. They were Rick, Josh, and Richie, all of them 3 or 4 years younger than me. They were from Portland, Eugene, and New Orleans, respectively. They'd all gone to college together at an insular Minnesota liberal arts school, an hour outside the Twin Cities.
"I'm from Minnesota," I exclaimed when they told me.
But they knew that already, from my notes in the trail register. "You don't have a trail name yet?" one of them asked me. "Not that I know of," I said. They had a trail name, the Three Young Bucks, which they'd been given by other hikers in Southern California, they told me. The name fit. They were three young and buckish men. They'd come all the way from the Mexican border. They hadn't skipped the snow like everyone else. They'd hiked over it, right through it, regardless of the fact that it was a record snow year. And because they'd done so, they were at the back of the Mexico to Canada through hiker pack, which is how, at this late date, they'd met me. They hadn't met Tom, Doug, Greg, Matt, Albert, Brent, Stacy, Trina, Rick, Sam, Helen, John, or Sarah. They hadn't even stopped in Ashland. They hadn't danced to the dead, or eaten chewable opium, or had sex with anyone pressed up against a rock on a beach. They just plowed right on through, hiking 20-some miles a day, gaining on me since the moment I'd leapfrogged north of them when I'd bypassed to Sierra City. They weren't just three young bucks. They were three young, extraordinary hiking machines. Being in their company felt like a holiday. We walked to the campsite the store set aside for us, where the three young bucks had already ditched their packs, and we cooked dinner and talked and told stories about things both on and off the trail. I liked them immensely. We clicked. They were sweet, cute, funny, kind guys, and they made me forget how ruined I'd felt just an hour before. In their honor, I made the freeze-dried raspberry cobbler I'd been carrying for weeks, saving it for a special occasion. When it was done, we ate it with four spoons from my pot and then slept in a row under the stars. In the morning, we collected our boxes and took them back to our camp to reorganize our packs before heading on. I opened my box and pushed my hands through the smooth Ziploc bags of food, feeling for the envelope that would contain my $20 bill. It had become such a familiar thrill for me now, that envelope with the money inside. But this time, I couldn't find it. I dumped everything out and ran my fingers along the folds inside the box, searching for it. But it wasn't there. I didn't know why, it just wasn't. I had $6.12. "Shit," I said. "What?" asked one of the young bucks. "Nothing," I said. It was embarrassing to me that I was constantly broke, that no one was standing invisibly behind me with a credit card or a bank account. I loaded my food into my old blue bag, sick with the knowledge that I'd have to hike 143 miles to my next box with only $6.12 in my pocket. At least I didn't need money where I was going, I reasoned, in order to calm myself. I was heading through the heart of Oregon, over Willamette Pass and Mackenzie Pass and Santiam Pass, through the Three Sisters and Mount Washington and Mount Jefferson wildernesses, and there'd be no place to spend my $6.12 anyway, right? I hiked out an hour later with the three young bucks, crisscrossing with them all day. Occasionally we stopped together for breaks. I was amazed by what they ate and how they ate it. They were like barbarians loose upon the land, shoving three Snickers bars apiece into their mouths on a single 15-minute break, though they were thin as sticks. When they took off their shirts, their ribs showed right through. I'd lost weight too, but not as much as the men. An unjust pattern I'd observed across the board in the other male and female hikers I'd met that summer as well. But I didn't much care anymore whether I was fat or thin. I cared only about getting more food. I was a barbarian too, my hunger voracious and monumental. I'd reached the point where if a character in one of the novels I was reading happened to be eating, I had to skip over the scene, because it simply hurt too much to read about what I wanted and couldn't have. I said goodbye to the three young bucks that afternoon. They were going to push on a few miles past where I planned to camp because in addition to being three young, incredible hiking machines, they were eager to reach Santiam Pass, where they'd be getting off the trail for a few days to visit friends and family. While they were living it up, showering and sleeping in actual beds and eating foods I didn't even want to imagine, I'd get ahead of them again and they'd once more be following my tracks. "Catch me if you can," I said, hoping they would. Sad to part ways with them so soon. I camped alone near a pond that evening, still aglow from having met them, thinking about the stories they'd told me as I massaged my feet after dinner. Another one of my blackened toenails was separating from my toe. I gave it a tug and it came all the way off. I tossed it into the grass. Now the PCT and I were tied. The score was 5-5. I sat in my tent with my feet propped up on my food bag, reading the book I'd gotten in my box, Maria Dermout's The 10,000 Things, until I couldn't keep my eyes open anymore. I turned off my headlamp and lay in the dark. As I dozed off, I heard an owl in a tree directly overhead.
Hoo, 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 hoo,
it hooted with a call that was at once so strong and so gentle that I woke up.
Hoo, hoo,
I called back to it, and the owl was silent.
Hoo, hoo,
I tried again.
Hoo, hoo,
it replied. I hiked into the Three Sisters Wilderness, named for the South, North, and Middle Sister Mountains in its boundaries. Each of the sister peaks was more than 10,000 feet high, the third, fourth, and fifth highest peaks in Oregon. They were the crown jewels among a relatively close gathering of volcanic peaks I'd be passing in the coming week. But I couldn't see them yet as I approached from the south on the PCT, singing songs and reciting scraps of poems in my head as I hiked through a tall forest of Douglas firs, white pines, and mountain hemlocks, past lakes and ponds. A couple of days after I'd said goodbye to the three young bucks, I took a detour a mile off the trail to the Elk Lake Resort, a place mentioned in my guidebook. It was a little lakeside store that catered to fishermen, much like the Shelter Cove Resort, only it had a cafe that served burgers. I hadn't planned to make the detour, but when I reached the trail junction on the PCT, my endless hunger won out. I arrived just before 11 in the morning. I was the only person in the place aside from the man who worked there. I scanned the menu, did the math, and ordered a cheeseburger and fries and a small Coke. Then I sat eating them in a rapture, backed by walls lined with fishing lures. My bill was $6.10. For the first time in my entire life, I couldn't leave a tip. To leave the 2 pennies I had left would have seemed an insult. I pulled out a little rectangle of stamps I had in the Ziploc bag that held my driver's license and placed it near my plate.
"I'm sorry, I don't have anything extra, but I left you something else," I said,
too embarrassed to say what it was. The man only shook his head and murmured something I couldn't make out. I walked down to the empty little beach along Elk Lake with the 2 pennies in my hand, wondering if I should toss them into the water and make a wish. I decided against it and put them in my shorts pocket just in case I needed 2 cents between now and the Olali Lake Ranger Station, which was still a sobering 100 miles away. Having nothing more than those 2 pennies was both horrible and just the slightest bit funny, the way being flat broke at times seemed to me. As I stood there gazing at Elk Lake, it occurred to me for the first time that growing up poor had come in handy. I probably wouldn't have been fearless enough to go on such a trip with so little money if I hadn't grown up without it. I'd always thought of my family's economic standing in terms of what I didn't get, camp and lessons and travel and college tuition, and the inexplicable ease that comes when you've got access to a credit card that someone else is paying off. But now I could see the line between this and that. Between a childhood in which I saw my mother and stepfather forging ahead over and over again with 2 pennies in their pocket, and my own general sense that I could do it too. Before I left, I hadn't calculated how much my journey would reasonably be expected to cost, and saved up that amount plus enough to be my cushion against unexpected expenses. If I'd done that, I wouldn't have been here, 80-some days out on the PCT. Broke, but okay, getting to do what I wanted to do, even though a reasonable person would have said I couldn't afford to do it. I hiked on, ascending to a 6,500-foot viewpoint from which I could see the peaks to the north and east, Bachelor Butte and glaciated Broken Top, and highest of them all, South Sister, which rose to 10,358 feet. My guidebook told me that it was the youngest, tallest, and most symmetrical of the three sisters. It was composed of over 24 different kinds of volcanic rock, but it all looked like one reddish-brown mountain to me, its upper slopes laced with snow. As I hiked into the day, the air shifted and warmed again, and I felt as if I were back in California, with the heat and the way the vistas opened up for miles across the rocky and green land. Now that I was officially among the three sisters, I didn't have the trail to myself anymore. On the high rocky meadows, I passed day hikers and short-term backpackers and a Boy Scout troop out for an overnight. I stopped to talk to some of them. "Do you have a gun? Are you afraid?" they asked in an echo of what I'd been hearing all summer. "No, no," I said, laughing a little. I met a pair of men my age who'd served in Iraq during Desert Storm and were still in the army, both of them captains. They were clean-cut, strapping, and handsome, seemingly straight off a recruitment poster. We took a long afternoon break together near a creek, into which they'd placed 2 cans of beer to cool. It was their last night out on a 5-day trip. They'd hauled those 2 cans the whole time so they could drink them on the final night to celebrate. They wanted to know everything about my trip, how it felt to walk all those days, the things I'd seen and the people I'd met, and what in the hell had happened to my feet. They insisted on lifting my pack and were stupefied to find that it was heavier than either of theirs. They got ready to hike away, and I wished them well, still lounging in the sun on the creek's bank. "Hey, Cheryl," one of them turned to holler once he was almost out of sight on the trail. "We left one of the beers for you in the creek. We did it this way so you can't say no. We want you to have it, 'cause you're tougher than us." I laughed and thanked them and went down to the creek to retrieve it, feeling flattered and lifted. I drank the beer that night near Obsidian Falls, which was named for the jet-black glass shards that wondrously covered the trail, making each step an ever-shifting clatter beneath me, as if I were walking across layers upon layers of broken china. I was less wonderstruck the next day as I walked over Mackenzie Pass into the Mount Washington Wilderness, and the trail became rockier still as I crossed the basalt flows of Belknap Crater and Little Belknap. These weren't pretty shiny shards of rock among spring-green meadows. Now I was walking over a 5-mile swath of black volcanic rocks that ranged in size from baseball to soccer ball, my ankles and knees constantly twisting. The landscape was exposed and desolate, the sun searing relentlessly down on me as I struggled along in the direction of Mount Washington. When I made it to the other side of the craters, I walked gratefully among the trees and realized the crowds had disappeared. I was alone again, just the trail and me. The following day, I hiked over Santiam Pass and crossed into the Mount Jefferson Wilderness, named for the dark and stately summit to my north. I hiked past the rocky, multi-peaked Three-Fingered Jack, which rose like a fractured hand into the sky, and continued hiking into the evening as the sun disappeared behind a blanket of clouds and a thick mist slowly enveloped me. The day had been hot, but within 30 minutes the temperature dropped 20 degrees as the wind picked up and then suddenly stilled. I walked as quickly as I could up the trail, the sweat dripping from my body in spite of the chill, searching for a place to camp. It was precariously close to dark, but there was no place flat or clear enough to pitch my tent. By the time I found a spot near a small pond, it was as if I were inside a cloud, the air eerily still and silent. In the time it took me to pitch my tent and filter a bottle of water with my insufferably slow water purifier, the wind started up again, in great violent gasps, whipping the branches of the trees overhead. I'd never been in a mountain storm. "I'm not afraid," I reminded myself, as I crawled into my tent without eating dinner, feeling too vulnerable outside, though I knew my tent offered little protection. I sat in expectant wonder and fear, bracing for a mighty storm that never came. An hour after dark, the air went still again, and I heard coyotes yipping in the distance, as if they were celebrating the fact that the coast was clear. August had turned to September. The temperatures at night were almost always bitingly cold. I got out of my tent to pee wearing my hat and gloves. When I scanned the trees with my headlamp, they caught on something, and I froze as the reflection of two bright pairs of eyes gazed back at me. I never found out whose they were. An instant later, they were gone. The next day was hot and sunny, as if the strange storm the night before had been only a dream. I missed a fork in the trail and later discovered that I was no longer on the PCT, but on the Oregon Skyline Trail, which paralleled the PCT roughly a mile to the west. It was an alternate route my guidebook detailed adequately, so I continued on, unworried. The trail would lead back to the PCT the next day. The day after that, I'd be at Olali Lake. Hop, skip, jump, done. I walked in a dense forest all afternoon. Once rounding a bend to come upon a trio of enormous elks who ran into the trees with a thunderous clamor of hooves. That evening, only moments after I stopped to make camp near a trailside pond, two bow hunters appeared, walking southbound down the trail.
"You got any water?" one of them burst out immediately. "We can't drink the pond water, can we?" asked the other, the desperation apparent on his face.
They both looked to be in their mid-30s. One man was sandy-haired and wiry, though he had a little belly. The other was a redhead, tall and meaty enough to be a linebacker. They both wore jeans with big buck knives hitched onto their belts and enormous backpacks that had bows and arrows slung across them.
"You can drink the pond water, but you need to filter it first," I said.
"We don't have a filter," said the sandy-haired man, taking his pack off and setting it near a boulder that sat in the small, clear area between the pond and the trail where I'd planned to camp. I'd only just set down my own pack when they'd appeared.
"You can use mine if you'd like," I said.
I unzipped Monster's pocket, took out my water purifier, and handed it to the sandy-haired man, who took it, walked to the mucky shore of the pond, and squatted down.
"How do you use this thing?" he called to me.
I showed him how to put the intake tube in the water with the float and how to pump the handle against the cartridge.
"You'll need your water bottle," I added.
But he and his big red-haired friend looked at each other regretfully and told me they didn't have one. They were only up for the day hunting. Their truck was parked on a forest road about 3 miles away, down a side trail I'd recently crossed. They thought they'd have reached it by now.
"Have you gone all day without drinking?" I asked.
"We brought Pepsi," the sandy-haired man answered. "We each had a six-pack. We're headed down to our truck after this, so we only need enough water to get us another bit, but we're both dying of thirst," the red-haired man said.
"Here," I said, going to my pack to pull out the water I had left, about a quarter of one of my bottles. I handed it to the red-haired man, and he took a long sip and handed it to his friend, who drank the rest. I felt sorry for them, but I was sorrier that they were here with me. I was exhausted. I ached to take off my boots and change out of my sweaty clothes, pitch my tent, and make my dinner so I could lose myself in the 10,000 things. Plus, I got a funny feeling from these men, with their Pepsi and their bows and their big buck knives, and the way they'd stormed right up to me. Something that gave me the kind of pause I'd felt way back in that first week on the trail, when I'd been sitting in Frank's truck, and I thought that perhaps he meant me harm, only to have him pull out licorice instead. I let my mind settle on that licorice.
"We've got the empty Pepsi cans," said the red-haired man. "We can pump water into your bottle and then pour it into two of those."
The sandy-haired man squatted at the pond shore with my empty water bottle and my purifier, and the red-haired man took his pack off and dug through it to get a couple of empty Pepsi cans. I stood watching them with my arms wrapped around myself, growing more chilled by the minute. The wet backs of my shorts and t-shirt and bra were now icy cold against my skin.
"It's really hard to pump," the sandy-haired man said after a while.
"You have to give it some muscle," I said.
"That's just how my filter is." "I don't know," he replied. "There's nothing coming out."
I went to him and saw that the float was all the way up near the cartridge and the open end of the intake tube had sunk into the muck at the shallow bottom of the pond.
I took the purifier from him, pulled the tube up into the clear water, and tried to pump. It was entirely locked, jammed solid with muck. "You weren't supposed to let the tube go into the mud like that," I said. "You were supposed to keep it up in the water."
"Shit," he said without apology.
"What are we gonna do?" his friend asked. "I've got to get something to drink."
I went to my pack, took out my first aid kit, and pulled out the little bottle of iodine pills I carried. I hadn't used them since I was at that frog-ridden reservoir on Hat Creek Rim and half out of my head with dehydration myself. "We can use these," I said, grimly understanding that I'd be drinking iodine water until I managed to repair my purifier, if it was even repairable.
"What are they?" asked the sandy-haired man.
"Iodine. You put them in and wait 30 minutes, and then the water is safe to drink." I went to the lake and submerged my two bottles in the clearest-looking spot I could reach and put iodine pills in each of them. The men followed suit with their Pepsi cans, and I put a pill in each. "Okay," I said, looking at my watch. "The water will be good to go at 7:10. I hoped that with that, they'd hike away. But they only sat down, settling in.
"So, what are you doing out here all by yourself?" asked the sandy-haired man.
"I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail," I said, and instantly wished I hadn't. I didn't like the way he was looking at me, openly appraising my body.
"All by yourself?"
"Yeah," I said reluctantly, equal parts leery of telling the truth and afraid to concoct a lie that would only make me feel more jangled than I suddenly did.
"I can't believe a girl like you would be all alone up here. You're way too pretty to be out here alone, if you ask me. How long of a trip are you on?" he asked.
"A longish one," I answered.
"I don't believe that a young thing like her could be out here by herself, do you?"
he said to his red-haired friend, as if I weren't even there. "No," I said, before the red-haired man could answer him. "Anyone can do it. I mean, it's just..."
"I wouldn't let you come out here if you were my girlfriend, that's for shit shock sure," the red-headed man said. "She's got a really nice figure, don't she?" the sandy-haired man said. "Healthy, with some soft curves, just the kind I like."
I made a complacent little sound, a sort of half-laugh, though my throat was clotted suddenly with fear. "Well, nice to meet you guys," I said, moving toward Monster. "I'm hiking on a bit farther," I lied. "So I'd better get going."
"We're heading out, too. We don't want to run out of light," said the red-haired man, pulling on his pack, and the sandy-haired man did, too.
I watched them in a fake posture of readying myself to leave, though I didn't want to have to leave. I was tired and thirsty, hungry and chilled. It was heading toward dark, and I'd chosen to camp on this pond because my guidebook, which only loosely described this section of the trail because it was not, in fact, the PCT, implied that this was the last place for a stretch where it was possible to pitch a tent. When they left, I stood for a while, letting the knot in my throat unclench. I was fine. I was in the clear. I was being a little bit silly. They'd been obnoxious and sexist, and they'd ruined my water purifier, but they hadn't done anything to me. They hadn't meant harm. Some guys just didn't know any better. I dumped the things out of my pack, filled my cooking pot with pond water, lit my stove, and set the water to boil. I peeled off my sweaty clothes, pulled out my red fleeced leggings and long-sleeved shirt, and dressed in them. I laid out my tarp and was shaking my tent out of its bag when the sandy-haired man reappeared. At the sight of him, I knew that everything I'd felt before was correct, that I'd had a reason to be afraid, that he'd come back for me. "What's going on?" I asked in a falsely relaxed tone, though the sight of him there, without his friend, terrified me. It was as if I'd finally come across a mountain lion, and I'd remembered, against all instinct, not to run, not to incite him with my fast motions or antagonize him with my anger or arouse him with my fear.
"I thought you were heading on," he said.
"I changed my mind," I said.
"You tried to trick us."
"No, I didn't. I just changed my..." You changed your clothes, too, he said suggestively, and his words expanded in my gut like a spray of gunshot. My entire body flushed with